I'm Thomas Messer, director of the Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum, and I would like to escort you, via this acoustic guide, to the top ramp where this guided tour begins. While you are en route to the top level, I would like to tell you the background of this 10th anniversary exhibition. But there's a great deal to tell, so if I'm still talking when you get to the top level, just wait there until I finish, perhaps looking down over the edge of the parapet at the panoramic sweep of the exhibition until it's time to begin the tour. The Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum is a museum devoted to 20th century painting, sculpture, and work on paper. It was founded in 1937 and opened activities in the Frank Lloyd Wright structure a little more than 10 years ago. The collection was started through a magnificent gift of paintings by the founder and was subsequently enriched through many other gifts and purchases. This exhibition, entitled 1900 to 1970, is on view throughout the summer. It is drawn entirely from our permanent holdings and therefore represents in some measure the museum's preference toward 20th century art. It must be remembered, however, that much that we wish we owned has so far eluded us, and that the collecting process continues beyond the present milestone. I have selected the works on view with the help of my staff, and we have jointly prepared a fully illustrated and documented catalog, which is obtainable through the sales desk. To the right, as you get out of the elevator, is the 7th ramp, where we are currently exhibiting works by younger artists represented in our collection, while to your left, the ramps unroll in chronological order. But I urge you to turn off your acoustic guide at the electronic signal you are about to hear. Inspect on your own the work of the new artists, and then rejoin me right here by the elevator stop. And now, with your back to the elevator, turn left to the first bay, marked 6-1 in small numerals on the left vertical partition, where the tour begins. Don't miss the beautiful and important sketch of a model by Edward Munch just before you get there. It's a recent acquisition, and we are very proud of it. Your guide through the museum is Dr. Louise Averill Swenson, who, through many years of close work with our collection, has gained an enviable familiarity with it. Dr. Swenson?
Thank you, Mr. Messer. On the left web of Bay 6-1 are the earliest works in the Guggenheim collection, four drawings by Georges-Pierre Seurat, while on the right web are four small paintings which he did during the same period, the late 80s. The paintings illustrate the technique for which Seurat was famous, pointillism, applying the paint with short strokes of separated color. Particularly in Seated Woman, there is no line drawing. These points of color, blues, reds, yellows, with some orange strokes between, convey a heaviness of the figure as she sits in a meadow, casting her shadow on the left. In a sense, the innovations of this neo-impressionist painter helped pave the way for the so-called modern painters whose work comprised the Guggenheim's collection. On the back wall to the left are two paintings by Henri Rousseau, who had an important influence on the generation of Picasso and Leger. And to the right is our one and only painting by Cézanne, who is considered to be the founding father of modern art. In The Clockmaker, one of Cézanne's famous portraits, we are presented with a figure contained in an almost geometric pattern in a shallow space. You are made to imagine the spherical volume of the head and to follow the pattern of the left shoulder coming forward and around and through the arm and the elbow and back in space and around and up the shoulder again. The shallowness of this space, retaining the sense of form and geometric pattern, is something which, as our tour progresses, you will see developed in the analytical cubism of Picasso and Braque. Turn off your acoustic guide at the signal. Spend as long as you care to studying these early works, and then proceed to Bay 6-2, and turn your acoustic guide back on again. This bay, with one or two exceptions, is devoted to the early development of the famous Russian expressionist painter, Vasily Kandinsky. On the left web are three very early oil sketches dating from the first decade of the 20th century. And here one sees Kandinsky influenced by the Impressionists in the use of vibrant and expressive color. From this Impressionist influence technique, he begins to develop his own mature style. And if you look at the three paintings on the back wall, you can see how he became less and less interested in painting the surface of nature than in turning that surface of nature into an expressive idea. In the painting to the left, he has abstracted nature until you can hardly realize that the blue form in the center is a mountain, that the masses of yellows to the left and the red oranges to the right are trees, but with no suggestion of individual foliage or branches. Those are horses in the foreground, but they are green and reddish, not of naturalistic colors, and their riders are reduced to the simplest coloristic forms. In the painting to the far right, a small study for a very much larger canvas, which Kandinsky painted in 1910, the rider form in the very center is so highly abstracted that you can only really identify the head and the sloping back of the white horse, with the rider now simply dots of color, green head, blue shadow, and yellow shoulder. Those other forms which scholars recognize from earlier studies are abstractions of such motifs as Russian onion dome churches, and in the lower right-hand corner, two lovers resting on the ground. This change from realism to complete abstraction has concerned modern artists for more than 50 years. When you are ready, move on to bay 6-3. Here in bay 6-3, in works by Picasso and Braque on the left web, we see the beginnings of cubism. As we saw Kandinsky moving away from the real world, by intensification of color and simplification of form toward abstraction, we see in the early Picasso on the left web how conventional 19th century still life is being disintegrated and reconstructed in geometric terms which we call cubism. We can recognize in the center a bowl of fruit, in the upper left a cruet, and a pitcher in the middle right. But these have been simplified and broken up into facets, which Picasso then rearranges into a very strict patternization and in a very limited depth in space, reminiscent of the approach we saw Cézanne use earlier. If we turn to the Braques, violin and palette on the left and piano and lute on the right, we will see that within a year, forms have become faceted to a point where it's becoming difficult for us even to recognize the instruments. The shapes are pulled almost vertically upward and recessed into a very, very narrow space from back to front. Continue the tour in bay 6-4. Here in bay 6-4, we see paintings of 1911-12, a crucial period when cubism was developing. On the back wall is a more developed Picasso than we saw in the previous still life of 1910. This is the famous accordionist, painted the year after the two Braques we saw in the bay before. Now, as I was anticipating, all interest in the scene, in the figure of the accordionist, has disappeared in favor of a geometric faceted structure. It is true that Picasso always starts from an object in nature, and here we still find vestiges. You can, for example, make out the fingers of the accordionist slightly to the right and below the center of the painting. But it is very difficult to make out the rest of the elements, which Picasso has now broken up and reconstructed in a very complicated composition. Picasso has also eliminated color, as we know it in Kandinsky, for example, and in other works in this bay. It is a typical analytical cubist work done almost in monochrome, in this case a kind of gray and yellow. I'm obviously discussing only a few of the highlights in this exhibition, and in this bay I certainly wish we had more time to examine each of these paintings in detail. But I can point out the influence of early Cubism on Leger in the famous Smokers, on the far right, on the back wall. To the left and right of that painting are two earlier works by Delaunay, who, one can see here, is influenced by Seurat in the use of the pointillist technique, but unlike the analytical cubists, was interested in pure color and light, as we see in that painting on the right web. Whenever you are ready, move on to bay 6-5. Here in bay 6-5, in the large painting on the right web called Circular Forms, dated 1912, we see characteristic handling of color by Delaunay. All suggestion of the natural world has disappeared. The surface is broken up into circular, disc-like forms in brilliant blues and yellows. On the left web, and to the left on the back wall, are works by the famous German expressionist Franz Marc. Marc, in contrast to Picasso and the other cubists, is interested in the world of nature, and in a very original and singular way. His concern is with the world of animals, as one can see in the large white bull. Next to it, the red deer, the horse asleep, and the riotous yellow cow on the back wall. Marc's animal world is a poetic, dreamlike one, very tender and very moving. Please spend as long as you care to here before moving on to bay 6-6. In bay 6-6, we introduce another personality, the Russian Marc Chagall, who came to Paris in 1910. There, his native folktale subject matter, romantic and intense color, was tempered by the compositional severity of Cubism. The most famous of these early works is in the center of the back bay, Paris Through the Window, where in a kind of proto-surrealist fantasy, varying elements of Paris are brought together. The view from Chagall's window is enlivened with strange and delightful images, characteristic of Chagall, as we will see in subsequent works in the collection. Now bay 6-7. In this bay we see developments of Cubism and various forms emanating from Cubism. Medrano, made by Archipenko in 1914, is one of the early Cubist sculptures. This Medrano circus figure combines tin, glass, wood, and oilcloth in a kind of assemblage that bears interesting similarities to Cubist paintings. It also heralds a new approach to sculpture in its use of space. An important character in the development of another form of abstraction is Piet Mondrian, whose very early watercolor and drawing of beautiful chrysanthemums are on the right web. Mondrian, influenced by the Cubists of Paris, began to develop his own type of abstraction, as you can see in the work in the center of the back wall, where he has abstracted the face of nature to the point where we have lost touch with it. Now it no longer bears, as did some of his earlier works, a title suggesting trees or churches or dunes, which, before 1913 at least, clued us in on the inspiration for the composition. The color, however, you might note, is the same as that of the analytical cubists of Picasso and Braque. Next, bay 6-8. We have now arrived, in 1913, at complete abstraction, as seen in the style of Vasily Kandinsky. Even the titles, as we noted in Mondrian, have lost any relationship with nature or any identification, and are called simply, as the two on the back wall, Painting with White Form, 1913, and Picture with White Edge. Later on, we'll see that they will simply be assigned numbers. And speaking of numbers, our tour continues in Bay 69. The two very famous panels on the back wall of Bay 69 are part of a group of panels which were commissioned for a New York apartment. The Museum of Modern Art has the other two panels, and together, the four are believed to represent the four seasons. Our two are autumn and winter, autumn on the left and winter on the right. After you have studied the contents of this bay, move down the ramp past the elevators and to the alcove that begins the fifth level. I'll meet you there by the two wire sculptures. These wire sculptures are by Alexander Calder, who at a later stage invented the famous mobile and is noted for his humorous and witty compositions. At the right is, of course, the amusing Romulus and Remus, those two founders of ancient Rome who were suckled by the wolf. Notice the variety of materials Calder has used and his signature in the wolf's tail. As you leave the she-wolf, walk over to the parapet and look directly across. You will see two early mobiles by Calder. In the bay after the she-wolf, Bay 5-1, I should like you to stop a moment and look at Albert Gleizes, the well-known portrait of an army doctor, is at the right on the back wall. You'll find four of seven pencil studies for it on the right web wall. And I think you'll get some idea of how the picture developed by looking at these pencil sketches on your own. Then, when you're ready, I'll meet you in Bay 5-2. In this bay, we see trends which developed during the war years of 1914-16. On the left web wall, I'd like to point out a painting by the Italian futurist Gino Severini. The main elements of futurism are quite evident here. Color and composition are used to intensify a feeling of speed and motion. On the back wall, to the left, is a famous early work of an Austrian expressionist, Oskar Kokoschka. Knight Errant shows the strong movement in Germany, Austria, and what is now Czechoslovakia toward an emphasis on emotional impact through exaggeration of form and intensification of color. Here, the palette has been deepened to affect a brooding, fearful, and highly charged atmosphere. The main figure is caught between tossing sea and sky in the throes of heightened religious experience. The letters ES in the sky, for instance, refer to Christ's agony during the crucifixion, where he cries, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Ironically enough, this painting was painted just before Kokoschka's enlistment and almost fatal wounding in the First World War. Before we leave this bay, look at the Egon Schiele next to the Kokoschka. It shows the same type of emotional expressionism in relation to the theme of old age. Look, for instance, at the hands and fingers, exaggerated far beyond natural proportions. On your way to Bay 5-3, don't miss the Mondrian on the right web. Our collection is famous for the four beautiful Modiglianis on the left web and back wall. They're characteristic of his work, and they may well be familiar to you. Another beautiful painting is Dining Room on the Garden by Pierre Bonnard at the far right on the back wall. Notice how the artist uses unusual color combinations, such as this intense violet and orange, to produce a mood of lightness, graciousness, and calm. When you're ready, I'll continue in Bay 5-4. Second from the left on the back wall, is a classic Mondrian. Mondrian's style developed from contrasts of curved and straight lines forming irregular planes to this mature phase where he reduced his composition to rectangular planes and restricted his palette to primary colors, red, yellow, blue, with grays, whites, and blacks. The dark outlines control the spatial relationship of the planes within them, so that within a very shallow space, some seem to be placed in front of others. Mondrian remained fascinated by such relationships until his death in 1944. But although his work continued within this limited palette and rectangular grid, each painting is distinct, with its own rhythm and effect. On the left web of Bay 55 is a work by Francis Picabia, who identified humanity not with calmness, but with cynicism, whose machine-like images mock the ideal. Picabia was a Dadaist working in that movement of the 20s, which reacted violently against tradition, often producing works deliberately without logical sense, directly opposite to the historic concept of art, with a capital A. Child Carburetor is painted with gold, black, and silver on natural wood. It is a kind of absurdist blueprint of the modern mind, complete with whimsical printed labels, such as To Destroy the Future, Crocodile Method, or The Dissolution of the Prolongation. But in spite of its mood, it's an extremely beautiful and elegant formal composition. Incidentally, the first large Picabia exhibition ever seen in America will be held at the Guggenheim at the end of September. Before meeting me in the next bay, do look at Picasso's splendid mandolin and guitar and the two monumental leges on the back wall. Here in Bay 56, we find more paintings concerned with fantasy and humor. On the left web is Landscape, also called The Hare, by Juan Miró. And to the left, on the back wall, is another, more abstract work by the same artist, entitled Personnage. In both cases, a kind of diagram is used for direction and mood, but it has no discernible symbolic logic to it. Personnage especially illustrates Miró's characteristic ability to animate the most unlikely forms. It has a dreamlike quality to it, which heralds the successor of the Dadaist movement, Surrealism. Let's move from fantasy to fantasy, from Miró to our most famous Chagall at the right on the back wall. The Green Violinist includes all his familiar motifs, floating people, Little Russian houses, donkeys, ladders, and, of course, the fantastic and marvelous figure of the violinist himself. Another art movement that sprang up in the 20s developed at an art school in Germany called the Bauhaus. There, artists were encouraged not to copy old masters, but to arrive at their own individual styles by experimenting with different techniques and materials. The architect Walter Gropius headed the distinguished group of artists who taught there, among whom were Vasily Kandinsky and Paul Klee. We've seen Kandinsky's work developing in earlier bays. Here on the right web and on the center back wall, we find paintings from his Bauhaus period. Now the free forms have stiffened and been reduced to circles, squares, and triangles. In the center of the right web is Levels, which demonstrates one of the tremendous varieties of mood that can be produced with such simple geometric forms. Here the shapes seem animated, almost like little animals, dancing gleefully in this rigidly defined, shelf-like structure. In the next bay, 5-7, we'll find geometric abstractions of a very different nature. On the right back wall is the majestic dominant curve, while accompanied contrasts on the right web is austere and delicate. Like all masters of the Bauhaus, Kandinsky experimented with materials, and if you look closely at accompanied contrasts, you'll see that sand has been added to the surface to give a variety of texture, softness, and hardness. Needless to say, the work is terribly fragile. In the next two bays, you'll find the work of Paul Klee, Kandinsky's contemporary and colleague at the Bauhaus. We have 120 Klees in our collection here at the Guggenheim, and many, I think, are among his most beautiful. Most Klees are accompanied by titles which give you some idea of the inspiration for each work, or an indication for your response to it. They are so subtle, intimate, and personal, I think you should look at these on your own. Look for the variety of materials he uses, painting sometimes on coarse burlap or fine gauze. Then meet me in Bay 4-1. All the works on this fourth ramp are from the 40s and the 50s, and as you move through them, you'll see an extension of many of the tendencies we've been looking at, the most important of which are geometric abstraction and abstract expressionism, as well as the beginning of new historical trends. In this first bay, 4-1, we find an example of geometric abstraction in the painting on the back wall to the left. Its composition on the name Rose by Herbin. The geometric figures and flat planes could only have grown out of the styles of Cubism, Mondrian, and Kandinsky. Notice how smooth the surface seems, giving hardly an impression of texture or brushstroke. Here in Bay 4-2, we find a continuation of the Surrealist style which developed in the 20s. The two sculptures, Anxious Friend by Max Ernst on the left and Giacometti's The Nose on the right, demonstrate the fantastic humorous side of this late Surrealism. But Rumblings of the Earth by the Cuban artist Wilfredo Lam shows the strange and savage aspects of the dream world. The weird bird-beast creatures and the knife-like forms owe a great deal to Picasso's work of the late 30s. Notice how the knife in the upper left center strikes a compositional direction downward, which counteracts the strong horizontal and diagonal lines and gives a sense of movement to the whole picture. Although we don't have time to stop in the next bay, I hope you'll do so on your own, for there you'll find Juan Miro's painting of 1953, which is at once powerful and whimsical, showing his fascination with primitive art in the drawings of children. I'll meet you again beyond that painting in Bay 4-4. Here we find the abstract expressionist movement, as epitomized by painting number 7 on the right back wall. It's by Franz Klein, one of the most famous Americans to work in this style, which indeed originated in this country. Abstract expressionism differs from geometric abstraction in that it involves the art of creating directly on the canvas, rather than transferring a design predetermined by sketch or formula to a canvas in a larger scale. The most important part is the artist's inspiration of the moment, without intellectual censorship being allowed to interfere. Obviously, this kind of style could not have occurred without Surrealism, for Surrealism implied the importance of subconscious inspiration, although Surrealism itself was not based on totally abstract images. Let's move on to the next bay, where you'll find the work of two other great American abstract expressionists. Here in Bay 4-5, we find Ocean Grayness by Jackson Pollock, a later work than the drip paintings you're probably familiar with. The thickness of paint and the direction of the brush strokes give us a sense of the surge of water. But I think it's both interesting and relevant that the title is the result of the painting rather than the inspiration for it. To the right is a composition of 1955 by Willem de Koning, one of the great colorists of the abstract expressionist movement. De Koning alternated between figurative painting, You may be familiar with his famous Woman series and Complete Abstraction. Although the colors here are discordant in their individual relationships, they are rich and harmonious overall. On the other hand, although the composition is carefully structured and divided into balanced segments, the general effect is as if the artist had attacked the canvas with his brush. Now, although I'm going to skip the next bay, I hope you'll stop there and look at the works which concentrate on the use of a variety of materials, such as wood, sand, burlap, and plaster. I'll see you in bay 4-7. On the left back wall is Shining Bank, a painting by Sam Francis done in 1958. Its vivid colors and drip technique are typical of his work. The element of chance produced by letting the drips work their own way almost autonomously on the canvas is also a part of the abstract expressionism of the 50s. Speaking of the importance of color in the 50s, one must pay homage to Joseph Albers, who is practically the father of much of the artistic theory of that decade. His homage to the square apparition hangs on the right web. Albers is a link between the Bauhaus school we discussed earlier and America, for at the Bauhaus he was both student and professor, and subsequently he was head of two university art departments in this country. His color theories have had a major influence on contemporary art. For 20 years, Albers has worked with the subject he calls Homage to the Square, in which square forms are worked and reworked in very subtle combinations of colors to give varying space relations and sensations in each picture. Look at this painting for a few seconds, and you'll see that each of the flat squares occupies its own plane, in what one might expect to be a depthless picture. Before you go to our next stop, I hope you'll rest for a few minutes in bay 4-9 and look at the Giacometti sketches you'll find there. Then meet me at the huge picture with ivy growing in front of it. It's at the beginning of the next ramp, just beyond the elevators. This is Saraband by the late Morris Lewis, and it introduces a new development in the vocabulary of art as we move toward the 60s. Lewis continues the interest in color we've just been discussing, but in his own personal way, using a method which he devised known as veil painting. The paint is not oil, but acrylic resin applied to raw canvas in layers of transparent color which are superimposed yet retain their individual identity. The center of the canvas is somber, but the bright, pure colors emerge at the edges. It is a beautiful and romantic work, which somehow seems to evoke nature without directly relating to it in any way. When you're ready, walk through Bay 31, noting the interest there in color and the way the paint is applied. I'll meet you in Bay 32. The painting to the right, in Bay 3-2, is different in both origin and intent from the last few pictures we've looked at. It's called Pearls and was created by Jim Dine in 1961. In Dine's work, we find a style which owes much to the Dada movement of the 20s and the Neo-Dada movement of the 50s. For here, a real object, the necklace, is actually affixed to the canvas and combined with realistically lettered title. This mixing of actual objects with painted objects, a play on illusion and reality, is characteristic of the movement familiarly known as pop art. Let's move to the brilliantly colored panels in Bay 3-5. Ellsworth Kelly's tremendous composition, Blue, Green, Red, Yellow, and Orange, epitomizes the work of the younger generation of artists who have grown out of the color theories that we've been following through the 50s and into the 60s. Here, each rectangular panel is devoted to one highly saturated color of equal value throughout. But the relationship of each panel to those flanking it creates an extraordinary optical illusion. If you stare at the meeting of blue and green, for instance, you'll find that a glowing stripe of changing intensity forms on either side of the join. And as you move from one panel to the other, the sense of vitality is continuous, as if the painting had a life of its own. Let the canvas play with your eyes for a few moments, and then meet me in Bay 3-6. Throughout the rest of this ramp, you'll see different uses of color for various optical or emotional effects. I would, however, like to point out the two albers in this bay to the left of the door, the studies for homage to the square, starting and closing. You can see how the yellow center opens up the picture, like light at the end of a tunnel, whereas the red center is like a sealed door marked no exit. I'd like you to continue to the end of the ramp. Our next stop is in Bay 3-9, the black and white work covering the optical lenses. It's to the right of the large archway. We've been looking at works which illustrate an interest in optics. Here, however, we are confronted with a creation by Mary Baumeister that does not rely on color for its visual effects. Optical lenses have been glued to the surface of this shallow box so that they extend and illuminate the spherical shapes beneath them. The shapes are also decorated with surreal designs which hold our fascination from one area to the next. It's both amusing and attractive, so I hope you'll spend some time studying this almost baroque profusion of forms, for they are really very beautiful. Just around the corner, still in Bay 3-9, although it's not set up like our other bays, is an example of op art. Vibration is by the Venezuelan artist Jesu Rafael Soto, who said, and I quote, "The elements I use are absolutely without value in themselves. They are used simply to demonstrate relations," unquote. I think you'll understand this concept if you stand directly in front of this work for a few moments and stare at a single rectangle. It and its neighbors may seem to recede or come forward. They may bend in space or begin to jitter and quiver, walk back and forth slowly, and the entire work will seem to vibrate. But this is merely your optical nerves, for it is a rigid structure made of metal and wood, and nothing at all is really moving. Our next stop is in the second bay on the next ramp, bay number 2-2. Three Studies for the Crucifixion by Francis Bacon is a unique work, different from anything we've seen so far. Unlike most pictures of the 50s and 60s, it harks back to traditional painting, to Rembrandt's rendition of Flayed Beef, for example, or the sacred triptychs, those three-paneled religious works of the Middle Ages. Bacon's brush, however, transforms these ancient formulae into a totally modern and nightmarish vision. For the artist is interested in ideas, painted not realistically, but with such powerful forms and slashing brushstrokes that even when the images are unspecific, we are aware he is interpreting the human condition. In other words, although the panels bear no specific relation to the conventional crucifixion, the suggestion of writhing bodies, blood, skeletal forms, and monstrous humans leave little doubt as to the nature of Bacon's inescapable and terrifying world. Now turn to your left and walk up the few steps into the high gallery. The huge canvas on the left wall comments more happily on the human condition. It's The Great Parade by Fernand Léger. We've already seen some cubist and post-cubist works by Léger. This one, however, was painted in 1954, the year before his death. It represents the culmination of the last 10 years of his work, a period during which the artist created a number of paintings which were essentially preliminary studies for this, including The Divers and The Acrobats. The Great Parade can be interpreted as a metaphorical statement of man, who, although part of a mechanized world enjoys a freedom of movement resulting in harmony and joy. This freedom is enhanced by the sweeping bands of color, which are no longer restricted to the outlined forms in the composition. Thus, Leger has progressed from an almost somber, mechanistic, analytical viewpoint to these figures, still somewhat robot-like, but smiling in their world of vibrant color. The multicolored fiberglass sculpture toward the middle of the gallery is a recent acquisition. It's by Jean Dubuffet and was given to the Guggenheim by the artist in honor of our director, Mr. Thomas Messer. Obviously, it relates directly to the long painting behind it, done in the same palette, basically blue, red, and black on a white ground. The interlocking shapes of the painting, entitled Nunc Stance, are typical of Dubuffet's work of the 60s. Although everything seems in pieces, it is all interwoven, integrated in an intricate pattern that is at once moving, disturbing, and intentionally ambiguous. Before leaving this gallery, I'd like to call your attention to the Henry Moore sculpture against the right wall. This huge figure, commissioned directly from the artist by the Guggenheim, is a key work in Moore's artistic development. Prior to this, he had been concentrating on reclining figures. This one may have started out that way, but it ended up as a vertical work and encouraged Moore to continue with monumental standing sculptures, both in metal and wood. When you are ready, leave the high gallery and go down the ramp, noting on your way the magnificent Caldermobile over the fountain, and stand in front of the ceramic portico by Juan Miró. This Stonehenge-like archway is made of fired clay, for stone would crack at the temperatures required to bake in the colored designs. The primitive aspect of the work is enhanced by the pebbles embedded in it and the simple enigmatic brush designs on its surface. A typical humorous touch is a set of footprints which march up the side you're looking at when you face the museum entrance. They lead nowhere, like the portico itself. Now let's walk over to the large painting beyond the metal sculpture. This monumental work is Preparedness by Roy Lichtenstein, painted in 1968. It is in the style we know as pop art, based on primary colors, mechanical lines, and Ben-Aid dots, like a color comic strip. This particular work also harks back to the popular art of the 30s, to the innocent optimism of the murals which reflected the invincible nature of the great giant America. Lichtenstein's comment on war and technology, however, is certainly as relevant to the world of the 70s as to any period that has gone before. I'm afraid that Lichtenstein's rather depressing comment on the human predicament has brought us to the end of our tour, but perhaps you can find some consolation in the quiet beauty of Brancusi's seal on its stone pedestal opposite Preparedness. At any rate, I hope you enjoyed this tour of highlights from the Guggenheim's own collection. When you hear the electronic signal, turn off your acoustic guide and return it to the desk from which you obtained it. Goodbye now, and thank you for joining me.